Okay, thank you. Yeah, so I was told to give a talk for a general audience, so I'm going, and of course, I don't actually know who you all are. So I'm going to try to explain things at a fairly high level. If I say anything you don't understand, please stop me. That said, I will once in a while give an aside just for people who I expect might know too much, or no, just enough. all of these terms I will define in the middle of the talk somewhere. The main one I want to get to is Laplacian matrices of graphs. But first, I just want to give you an overview of what's going on. So the problem of solving systems of linear equations, which I will explain in more depth soon, is a classic one that's been studied in numerical linear algebra for a very long time. And what this talk is about very fast algorithms for solving very special families of linear equations. They're called linear equations. The matrices that define them are called the Laplacian matrices of graphs, and they come up in a lot of applications. I'm going to emphasize the applications that come up in graph theory, but I'll mention a few others as well. So the interesting thing about this work is that we're building on a long chain of results of other people. And while we're solving a problem that seems like a problem in linear algebra, the tools that come to bear in this problem come from many, many different disciplines of mathematics. And you wind up seeing random matrix theory and spectral graph theory and regular graph theory and lots of developments in algorithms, people studying random walks and graphs. There's just a lot of things that have come into play in the solution of this problem. And then, in turn, in solving it, we developed a lot of other tools in graph theory that have then gone on to have a life of their own. Other people improving them and using them for all sorts of things that we never anticipated. So my main goal in this lecture is just to give you, I call it, an introduction to the characters involved in the story and to explain to you some of the relations that they have between each other, mainly just so you're familiar with them and you see some interesting things that are going on and also see some interesting things that have been used or put to new use far beyond what people anticipated. So... oh, I should mention, just to explain my picture, this is a graph. It was sort of one of the motivating examples. One of the things you'll see in this talk is a notion of what it means to approximate a graph by another graph, one with fewer edges. This is an example of that graph where we have dropped out many of the edges, and it turns out to be a very useful approximation, at least as far as solving systems of linear equations is concerned. Okay, so formally my outline for my talk is I'll begin with just talking a little bit about what graphs are to me in general, what we do with graphs, talk about physical metaphors for graphs, which is one of the main ways I understand graphs anyway, and it comes up a lot. After explaining these things, you can understand this as explaining what Laplacian matrices are for. I can then eventually tell you pretty much what Laplacian matrices are, but that comes about the middle of the talk, so I hope you'll bear with me to that part. Then I can tell you about linear equations and Laplacian matrices and how we solve them, and then about a bunch of the interesting things that come up while we're doing it. So I think I listed here approximations of graphs, things called low-stretch spanning trees, sparsification, and vocal clusters. Maybe there's some more I forgot to stick in the outline. Okay, so first, graphs, or as they're popularly called today, networks. People usually think about these first now in terms of social networks, so that's the description I've given here. We draw a picture. They usually have a set of vertices or nodes. These are usually drawn as circles or blobs. In social networks, they represent people. And a graph is designed to represent the connections between them. So in particular, the connections we call edges. And these I've usually drawn here as lines connecting two of the nodes. And that's usually how we draw a graph. Usually when we draw a graph, we have the nodes, and then we have edges connecting pairs of them. Often when we just write about graphs, rather than drawing pictures, I describe each edge as a pair. Like here, there's an edge between Dan and Donna. I will often describe them as a pair and put between parentheses with the names of the vertices attaching them. Out of curiosity, how many of you here are sort of familiar with graphs? Almost everyone. Good. Okay. It doesn't always happen that way when I talk to some of my colleagues at Yale. One thing I want to emphasize is... that all the graphs I will show you have been chosen so that I can draw them on the screen. But usually it is difficult to draw graphs. graphs that are small you can draw, but big social networks, there is no nice picture of usually. So that's one way in which I'm going to be a little bit deceptive here. Here's another example of a graph. This is the famous airfoil mesh. It's now actually built into MATLAB. You type airfoil, you get this thing. It's an example from a mesh that was drawn for studying airflow around an airplane wing. And it's finer where there's more going on. This is a sort of graph that comes up in scientific computing type applications. So, you know, usually you get 3D meshes, but those are harder to draw. Now, this is the sort of graph a mathematician might give you, where I've drawn numbers with edges going between numbers and things that divide them. Again, you can draw it for a small graph. If I got too big, this thing gets pretty messy. The other thing I've been deceptive here is all these graphs I've drawn are planar, meaning they can all be drawn on the screen without crossing edges. But usually life is not that good. Almost never. Okay, so one reason I show you three different graphs is I want to point out that graphs come from a huge number of applications. And one danger when studying graphs is if you just work in one domain, you get some ideas about graphs that you think are true. And those ideas usually don't hold when you go to another domain. So graphs in different domains look very different from each other. Even worse things happen. If you take any two graphs, draw them on the screen and glue them together, put a couple edges between them, you get this nasty chimeric graph that has properties of both but doesn't really look like either. So one of the reasons I draw pictures like this is to point out that it is really hard to understand what a graph looks like. And occasionally people come by my office and say, you know, Dan, I have this graph. Can you tell me what it is or what it means or what it looks like? And I'll tell you a little bit about how we try to do that, just a little. I sometimes give whole lectures on that topic. The first question we ask is, can I come up with a good picture of your graph? If I can draw your graph, that then tells me a lot. Then I understand a lot about it. Those drawings I showed you before really tell you about the graph. But usually when someone is handing me a graph, they're not handing me a picture. They're handing me a list of the names of vertices and a list of the edges. And then it's a question, can you draw it? Unfortunately, most graphs you cannot draw nicely. So I will go for a rougher goal that I call sketching, or trying to at least get some idea as to what the overall structure is like. You try to come up with some simple approximation of the graph that you can understand. One way of doing this is finding what we call communities or clusters within a graph. So a community or cluster, roughly, should be a set of nodes that are better connected to themselves than they are to the rest of the graph. And often when you're faced with a graph, you want to try to divide it into communities or clusters to identify those. It helps you understand the structure, if your graph has communities and structures. Another problem I sort of mentioned is sorts of learning problems or inference problems that occur on graphs. And that's one of the motivations for the work I'll talk about today. That said, I have these dot, dot, dots here. And of course, many of you know, graphs are probably the most popular abstraction used in computer science. They show up all over the place and... All right, I'm barely touching on what people do with graphs. Okay, so let me talk about clustering. This is something I care about a lot. It will come up a lot. So our notion of a cluster is going to be a set of vertices. So here I've drawn a graph. The colors aren't coming through great, but I circled a set of the vertices. And I think of them as being sort of a cluster because there are a fair number of edges inside and only four edges leaving, these ones here. Now, that's a very qualitative idea. Usually you want to make that quantitative. You don't actually usually say this set of nodes is a cluster or this is not. You measure how good of a cluster is it. And one way of measuring that is by measuring what I'll call the cluster quality. That is the size of the boundary. By boundary, I mean the edges leaving it. Sometimes divided by the size of the set of nodes is a decent measure of cluster quality. The lower number this is, the better the set is as a cluster. So the fewer edges leaving, at least relative to the size of the set, then we often think of that as giving you a better cluster. Sometimes you want to divide by maybe the number of edges touching the nodes, not just the size of the set. But you'll look at something like that. Okay, so this is a notion of a cluster of nodes. It's going to play a very important role when we think about understanding graphs. Let's ask if there are any questions on how I set this. Yes?
Are edges always the same throughout?
So it depends what you mean. So when you say the same. So We do sometimes talk about weighted graphs, and I'll talk about that in a moment, where edges have different weights or different strengths. You can think of some connections as being more important than others. So that's one way of thinking of varying these things that we will need to do often. But at the first level of abstraction, it's easiest for me to talk about having an edge or not an edge rather than how strong the edge is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, so I mean, if you cut off a single vertex, I usually don't think of that as being a great cluster. Unless... Oh, you said that the remainder. No, the,
yeah,
re-
the remainder.
I know, because... Oh, yes, it does. Okay, so that's a good question. If you're looking at dividing the graph into two pieces, you always want the smaller part to be your cluster. It's actually a very good question. So if you tell me, take a look at the, everything but one vertex, I say, that's not a cluster. That's most of your graph. The one vertex was your cluster. And then you measure the quality of that. That's a very important question. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay, so learning on graphs, there are a lot of ways of doing this. I'm mentioning here a paper by Zhu, Garamani, and Lafferty, though maybe not the application they suggested. So let's imagine that you are trying to get people to donate to some charity. So what do you do? You call up people and you make your pitch. And then the people who accept your pitch and donate, those are great. You give them a one. And then there are other people who don't accept. That's probably most of them. And you give them a zero. And now you have this problem. Probably if you just keep calling people, they usually say no. So you might ask yourself, how can you try to find people who are more likely to be ones than zeros, who are more likely to accept? So, okay, you go to Facebook and buy the social network graph from them. And then you figure, huh, maybe the friends of people who are ones are more likely to buy than the people who are zeros. So now you've got a problem. If I give you a graph and I give you some nodes, and I have values of a function on some nodes, in this case it was one or zero, and you might try to estimate the values of the functions at the remaining nodes, assuming that people who are friends will be similar. I don't know how good an assumption that is, but you can do it. The way they suggest doing that is you try to assign numbers to every other node so these numbers don't vary too much across the edges. Where I'll make the notion of varying precise in a moment, but the notion of Zhu, Garamani, and Lafferty would give you some sort of numbers like this. So at least this node here is closer to the ones than the others. These are somewhere in between. Of course, it's a more interesting problem when you have a much larger graph. But this is a sort of problem for which we'll see Laplacian matrices become useful. But I want to tell you about the problems they help us solve first, which is, again, I say, given sort of any function, assigning numbers to vertices in a graph. How do I try to guess what the function might look like, assuming it doesn't vary too much across edges? Okay, so those were two sort of applications. Let me tell you a little bit about how I try to think about these things. So again, graphs are very abstract things. So for me to think about a graph, I like to pretend it is some sort of physical object. And then I can at least deceive myself maybe into thinking my physical intuition is helping me understand it. So here are some of the metaphors that I like that are related to the applications I just mentioned. One is thinking of edges in a graph as rubber bands or springs, perhaps. I often like to think of the edges as pulling things together, and maybe the nodes are little rings that those rubber bands or springs are linked around. And I think of the behavior of this system as somehow trying to tell me about a graph. Another metaphor we like to think of is an electrical one, where I think of edges as being resistors. And vertices are just points at which those are welded together. And then you can think, if you make that sort of metaphor, you can think about how does electricity flow in this structure if you, say, attach some nodes to terminals of the battery. Another sort of popular metaphor is thinking about processes that happen on a graph. Sometimes the simplest of these are you imagine that there's some substance that lives on the nodes, like maybe it's a gas or a liquid, and you pour a bunch of it. Think of spilling coffee into some node of a graph. What's going to happen, it's going to diffuse throughout the edges and move to neighboring nodes. We like to look at processes like this and understand how it behaves, and that will help us understand a graph. And this is very closely related to what people talk about with random walks on graphs. I won't explain the exact analogy, but that's where you start at a node and you move to a random neighbor of that node at every step. Yes? Mm-hmm. Here I've made an edge two-way connection for simplicity, let's say. So you can also talk about directed graphs in which edges are one-way connections, and then your life becomes far more difficult, but you can model much more. Yes, that's right. In That's right. Oh, so she was saying, so there was, okay, so there were, you said two things that were related. Let me try to tease them both apart. So one is what you can think about whether or not my edges are directed. For example, if you think about something diffusing in a network, you could have a valve. If it imagines the liquid diffusing across edges, you could have a valve on one of the edges, only allowing liquid to flow one way, like you do within your veins. Or you could imagine if some process is happening on a graph, you can imagine only being able to go one way across an edge as opposed to another. And then we get what we call directed graphs, where you have directions on your edges. And I'm not going to talk about directed graphs for two reasons. One, because we don't understand them nearly as well. And a lot of the theory I've developed here, we do not have firmly developed for directed graphs. And two, because it's just a level of complication I want to avoid. The other thing you mentioned is if you think about electrical flow, which is different than this notion of diffusion. You think about attaching a positive terminal of a battery to one node in a graph and a negative terminal to another. Actually, you can sort of understand that as diffusion with things, a constant flow coming in, a positive charge going in one way and negative flow going the other. I describe, imagine a network just of resistors. If you stuck diodes in here, then you get some nonlinearities or discontinuities, but then you get directed graphs. And don't stick in capacitors, then you get a theory that's really intractable. Well, at least not cleanly, anyway. We'll keep it to, in other words, we'll keep it to the things that you understand in a high school physics course. The others, they need, at least my high school certainly didn't get beyond resistors and diodes. Okay, let me just give you a quick picture of diffusion because I don't get to talk about it much in this lecture. I just want to show you one example. So imagine here is a very simple graph where I've really tried to put the nodes into two different clusters, and I put all of my mass or stuff at one vertex here. And this is time step zero. And I imagine the processes in which half of it stays put and half moves to the neighbors. I don't know if that's exactly half. I tried to draw dots that were approximately like that. So you can imagine that this stuff will spread out. One thing you see, which is interesting, is this sort of cluster structure means that initially not that much of the gas diffuses over here, and it actually spreads pretty well over here first. This is actually very much related to one of the ways we try to identify clusters in a graph, is examining how this process behaves with different starting conditions. And by varying your initial conditions, you can find different clusters. Of course, eventually, the mass will be diffused throughout the graph. So at time step six, it is not even. So I should just mention, understanding this is very closely related to Laplacian matrices, understanding how this behaves. I haven't told you what they are yet, but one of the things they will do is they will give us an understanding of the behavior of diffusion. Okay, let me do the physical metaphor. So first think about springs. This is a very simple graph. I have four nodes connected in a line, and you can imagine treating the edges as ideal linear springs, attaching the vertices. And what you do is you can nail down some of the vertices. These are what we call boundary constraints. They're very hard constraints. You fix the location of some vertices, and you can see what happens. What position will the other vertices achieve when you let the system settle? You know, they'll bounce around for a while, but there's some unique one equilibrium position. So physics tells us what that position will be. If you have a spring and it's stretched to length L, the potential energy in the spring is the square of L, or L squared over 2. We'll drop the 1/2. It won't matter much. Physics tells us that the position that you get is the one that minimizes the total potential energy. So I'm going to use this slide to introduce notation. A vertex, I'll give a name like A. I will let X of A be its position. These you can think of as being real numbers on the real line here. So the length of one of the edges, you can write as something like x of a minus x of b. So if ab is an edge, this means sum over all edges, the square of the length is x of a minus x of b squared. So this is the formula for the potential energy. We'll see this formula a lot, so I will explain it a few different ways. But one of the main things to know is that physics tells us where these vertices will settle is at the position that minimizes this subject to the boundary constraints. So let me show you my favorite example of this, Hutt's theorem from 1963. Hutt proved that if you had a planar graph and you took one cycle in it, like this face that I drew on the outside, and you nail down all the vertices in that cycle and let the rest of the vertices settle, you get a planar embedding of the graph, meaning no edges crossing. Which, this is a paper he wrote called How to Draw a Graph. It only applies to planar graphs, which I know are a very special family. But it is the one of the first real uses I know of this physical metaphor for graphs. This was, I think it was the really first interesting theorem in the field of graph drawing. Now, it doesn't always give you the best pictures. If you look at this example, if I kept putting things in here, they'd get smaller and smaller and smaller together, and the picture would become a little inconceivable, but then you can work on trying to fix that. But understanding this physical system gives you a way to draw these planar graphs. I just want to mention one other reason I find this amazing, at least as a mathematician. This is, you know, just a paper with theorems in it. If I were to do this, if I were to try to prove this today, I would have run thousands of MATLAB experiments confirming my conjecture on zillions of examples and drawing them all before I would have the guts to actually try to prove such a theorem. You know, Tut didn't do that, I'm pretty sure. Okay, so let me mention the electrical metaphor. You think about resistors. We have less physical intuition for this, but it's a more powerful metaphor. So you can imagine, again, the edges being resistors. You attach, say, one of the nodes to 1 volt, another to ground, and you can look at the voltages induced when you do that, and you can look at how much current flows. So there are a number of reasons to do this. One of them is the more, when you have more current flow, it sort of measures the strength of the connection between those two nodes in the graph, not just in terms of an edge directly connecting them, but more current will flow if you have many more paths between them, especially many more short paths. So the same way that edges represent connections, sort of the amount of current that will flow between two nodes, if you make them unit resistors, measures sort of how well connected they are when you take all of the edges in the graph into account. So at least, if there, yes?
So when you're talking about flowing from one point to another, I understand what that means if you were drawing a 1 volt to 0 volt.
Yes. Oh, so if you do it electrically, there is always a unique answer that electricity will take, at least. If you think about arbitrary sorts of flows, no, it's not. But physics gives us one unique answer for electricity. And it's an answer that's going to make a lot of sense to you in a moment. So, oh, this is the induced voltages that you get here, by the way. So where do they come from? There's a notion of energy dissipation in an edge, and it's the same sort of formula. If V of A is the voltage I'm assigning to node A, physics tells us what you will minimize is the sum across edges of the square of the discrepancy of the voltages across the edges. This is the exact same formula that showed up with the rubber bands. And you can actually put these really in one-to-one correspondence, the electrical networks and the rubber band networks. Although in the rubber bands, you don't see anything flowing. But the positions of the nodes in the rubber bands are equivalent to the voltages that we get out here. So we know exactly the formula for what the voltages minimize. And by the way, this is exactly what was going on in that paper of Zhu, Garamani, and Lafferty. I told you that they suggested trying to fit a function on the vertices subject to a couple known values so that you don't vary too much across edges. The measure that they chose is exactly this same one. The idea is they sum of the squares of the differences of their function across the edges, and that's what they tried to minimize. So they tried to minimize the same thing that people studying electrical circuits have been understanding electricity minimizes forever. This is fundamentally what they looked at. So this is a term that comes up in a lot of places. So this term is really what defines the Laplacian matrix. I may never tell you what the Laplacian matrix is, but I tell you what we call the Laplacian quadratic form, which just means if I give you a graph with vertices V and edges E, what this does is it tells you how nice is a function on the vertices. It tells you if I assign a real number X to every vertex, what we now do, our graph gives us a measure on that. We sum across all edges is the square of the difference of our function across those edges. That's what we call the Laplacian quadratic form. I'll tell you in a moment how that defines a matrix, but let me give you an example. So here's a very simple graph. Here is a function x that I've assigned to the vertices. So I've just mapped some arbitrary numbers onto the vertices. And the way you evaluate this is you take a look at every edge. You take a look at the difference across the edges of the values. You sum up the differences and you square them. So in this case, this graph with this function x would give us the value 15, which is the sum of those differences squared. So really this Laplacian quadratic form, which is a measure of what we call how smooth a function is on the graph, that's the way I think about graphs and the Laplacian matrix. So for those who know linear algebra, you might recall that any function like this, a quadratic form, you can write in terms of vectors and matrices. If x is a vector, you can write it as x transpose Lx for some matrix L. And that matrix L is the Laplacian matrix. And everything you want to know about it, its entries, its null space, you should not derive from looking at the actual entries of the matrix. You derive it from this, which is why I'm just going to talk about this Laplacian quadratic form, and we'll pretend we all understand Laplacian to that, and actually in reality, if you think about this, you do. Books tend to do it the reverse way. They tell you about the matrix, and then they derive that thing, but it's the wrong direction to go. Okay, I do want to mention, so usually what I was talking about on those previous slides was minimizing the Laplacian. I said, imagine you minimize this quadratic form subject to boundary constraints. That problem always turns into a problem of solving a system of linear equations. And it's a system of linear equations in this Laplacian matrix L. So most of you can trust me on that. For the rest of you, I will mention to see that formally, you know that the minimum occurs when all the partial derivatives are zero. So you set the partial derivatives to be zero here, and you find that you get an equation of this form. So that's formally why it happens. So this is one of my motivations for the problem of trying to solve systems of linear equations in Laplacian matrices. Every time I want to do one of these calculations, figure out how electricity flows in a resistor network, do learning on graphs, or a bunch of others I'll show you in a moment, the way we do the calculation is by solving a system of linear equations in that matrix. Let me give you another example. Back to clustering, measuring the boundaries of sets. So let's say I have a graph, and I have a set of vertices S. I want to show you that the Laplacian is related to the number of edges on the boundary. And one way of doing that is we take as our function what's called the characteristic vector of this set. It's 1 at every single vertex in the set and 0 outside the set. And now you take a look at what you are summing up in this quadratic form. Let me remember if I put it on the next slide. I think so. Yes. What this quadratic form does is it sums over every single edge. I don't know if you can see the bottom here. The difference between the values of the function at the endpoints of that edge squared. So think about this. If I have an edge on the boundary, you're taking a difference of a 1 and 0 and squaring it. That's 1. If you have edges that are outside the set, you get both zeros. There's no difference. It doesn't count. Edges between vertices inside the set, you both get 1. There's no difference. It doesn't count. So the Laplacian quadratic form enables us to count the size of a boundary, the number of edges going into a set, leaving it. Just you plug in as x the characteristic vector of a set. If you wanted to measure cluster quality, which I called the size of the boundary divided by the size of the set, it's the same thing, but you get a ratio. The quadratic form up top, x transpose Lx, divided by the norm of x down bottom, it's x transpose x. And this will be familiar to some of you who've studied eigenvalue problems. This is exactly how you get eigenvalues for symmetric matrices. They come up as ratios like this. Garcia, how many of you have studied eigenvalue problems? Or a good number. Wow, great. Okay. So, yeah, then you will have seen this formula come up by the name of a Rayleigh quotient, usually. And I should mention, as I was asked before, weighted graphs also come up. Of course, you don't just want to look at a graph. Sometimes you want to measure what is the strength of a connection. We measure that by putting in what we'll call the weight of an edge. And you can think of this as being, you know, the strength of a connection, if it's a social network. If it's a spring network, you can think of this as being the spring constant. How stiff is it? Or for electrical networks, this should really be 1 over the resistance. Better connected means less resistance. That's why it should be 1 over resistance. Or high resistance means really poorly connected. Like air is very high resistance. So, you know, if there's just nothing between two vertices, we think that is infinite resistance. Okay, so linear equations. Given the show of hands, not many of you need reminding what linear equations are, but I put up a slide to be safe. So they usually say we've given a matrix A and a vector B, we usually write them as AX equals B, and you're trying to solve for this X. And this usually can break out what the matrix looks like, and it looks like a bunch of things like this that you're trying to solve all at once. X is a bunch of variables. You want to solve a bunch of equations at once. This is sort of one of the classic problems of linear algebra. We learn how to do this. I mean, some of us learn how to do these problems even in high school for the really small ones. For the really big ones, usually that waits till a linear algebra course sometime in college. So I should mention, I see before I go on to talking just about Laplace and linear equations, I want to mention solving linear equations in general is one of the computational bottlenecks in a huge number of applications. So there are a huge number of places where if you're running code from optimization, especially in a lot of code in machine learning and in a lot of parts of scientific computing, where most of the computation time is going to solving systems of linear equations. And coming up with faster ways of doing this actually really will speed up a lot of applications. Also, the thing I want to point out is in most of those applications, people are not solving arbitrary systems of linear equations, meaning they weren't. Usually, they are solving them because they're somehow special. For example, usually they know there's a solution a priori for some other reason. And it is my belief that that knowledge can often be built into the design of faster algorithms for solving systems of linear equations. Now, people in scientific computing do this all the time, and people in physical sciences. This thought process has not made its way very far into the applications in optimization or in machine learning or a lot of other places where we solve systems of linear equations. It's getting there, but there's a lot more we can do. You know, other than for those who use MATLAB, you just type backslash and it solves the system of linear equations for you. It's very convenient. I love it. But you can do much better. Okay, so here, at least for Laplacian, I want to mention a couple of what I'll call classic applications. First, of course, is understanding resistor networks and computing flows and electrical networks. Solving elliptic partial differential equations, if you use the finite element method, say, following Strang's book, Introduction to Applied Mathematics, if you follow the chapters through at the end, you see that if you use the right sort of triangulation, which he does, you get a system of linear equations in a Laplacian matrix. If you want to compute eigenvalues and eigenvectors of Laplacian matrices of graphs, at least the ones that we usually care about, which are the low ones, not the high ones, then you do it by solving systems of linear equations. And let me mention, if you solve the maximum flow problem, a classic problem from operations research, it's a linear program. One of the main ways we solve linear programs is by a type of algorithm called the interior point method. Again, people usually just know they exist. They don't know what they're doing. If you look at what the interior point method is doing, when you're solving a maximum flow problem, at every single iteration, you are solving a system of linear equations in a Laplacian matrix. Once you know that, you can design a much faster algorithm than if you're just using a black box linear equation solver. There are also some more recent applications. So I told you at the beginning of the talk, and I'll tell you more about in a moment, we now have incredibly fast algorithms for solving Laplacian linear equations. This has led people to think of using these as computational primitives, like sorting. If you're designing an algorithm, you say, okay, let me sort my data. That will help. If you're designing an algorithm now, you say, oh, you've got a Laplacian linear equation. Let's just do that. It's practically free compared to the rest of the algorithm. So now if you think there's a primitive, you discover there are other things you can do. So Kellner, Modry, and Propp came up with new algorithms for generating random spanning trees and sort of statistical physics-y problems people have worked on for a long time. I and colleagues have come up with now faster algorithms for maximum flow based on this, and there are a bunch more papers that are coming out. At least I see a few now under submission. So this is something that I think we'll see a lot of soon. Okay. So let me just go back to the basics of how you solve systems of linear equations. If you took a course in linear algebra at one point, you learned Gaussian elimination. And that will work, but it's sort of slow usually. If you have n unknowns, it can take time order n cubed. That's the worst case upper bound, and sometimes that happens. That we think of as being too slow for a large problem. That said, sometimes it's much faster. And there is a lot of work people have done to try to make Gaussian elimination as fast as possible when you can. And there's code for doing it. And we'll exploit some of that. So for simple systems, sometimes you can do this much faster. Another method you probably don't learn unless you take a course in numerical linear algebra is the conjugate gradient method. This is an iterative algorithm. It doesn't do anything like compute an inverse of a matrix. So it's sort of one shot. It gets you a solution to one system of linear equations. But it can be much faster, at least if the system is symmetric and positive, semi-definite, for those who know what that is. It takes time sort of order nm, where n is the number of unknowns and m is the number of non-zero entries in the matrix. So if your matrix, usually our matrix has very few non-zeros, usually on order number of vertices. Sort of like our graph, usually the number of edges is sort of proportional to the number of vertices. Then we get down to order n squared. But it's even faster than that. There are a lot of times in this algorithm gives you very fast approximate solutions to systems of linear equations. And I should mention some really bizarre examples. I mean, like, if we take the Laplacian matrix of a random graph, this algorithm is blindingly fast, in spite of the fact that random graphs are somehow very complicated. One really important thing I want to mention about this problem is you can always check if you got the right answer. So if you get an x, you can plug it in and see if ax equals b. This is very important because there's a huge number of heuristics and tricks that have been developed for solving systems of linear equations. Most of them people can't prove a darn thing about, but they use them anyway because at least when they're done, they can check if they got the right answer. So as long as it runs quickly enough, they usually don't worry. I unfortunately can't even begin to tell you about all the work that goes into it, but someone from one of the national labs, I think it was Bruce Hendrickson, once told me that designing linear equation solvers is sort of like making sausage. You don't want to know what goes into it. Okay, for those, again, who are no linear algebra, I just want to mention some of the things you can discover from the structure of Laplacian are that the matrix is symmetric. You get one non-zero entry for every vertex and edge. So the number of non-zeros depends on the edges you have. It's positive semi-definite. The null space we completely understand and can therefore ignore. If you take the characteristic vectors of components of the graph, if it's connected, just take the L1 vector. It's diagonally dominant. We will solve systems of linear equations in Laplacian by an algorithm that's called the preconditioned conjugate gradient. It is my favorite algorithm. I don't have time to tell you enough about it. I'll tell you the key point. What you do with preconditioned conjugate gradient is you find an approximate problem, like an approximation of your original matrix or an approximate graph. It can be a crude approximation. And you're just going to solve repeatedly systems of equations in this approximate system, but get arbitrarily good answers to your original problem. So as high accuracy as you want, you get to your original problem. It just increases how many times you need to solve the crude approximation. Okay, so now I can tell you about the approach that we are following. It follows the suggestion of Pravin Vaidya from 1990. He said we're going to precondition, which is their word, numerical linear algebra for approximate, Laplacian matrices by Laplacian matrices of subgraphs. So you have a graph, we'll take a subgraph. That is, we throw away some edges, and we use that as an approximation. And we then are going to use that to design our linear system solvers. Now, one thing to know about Vaidya's work, it was never published. He gave a talk. He distributed a manuscript to a few people. His paper on the topic was rejected from the conference he sent it to. His grant proposal was rejected. And he said to heck with it, and he just decided to start a company that solves linear equation solvers. He was ahead of his time. In order for someone to competently review his work, they had to know both numerical linear algebra and some real graph theory and algorithms. And maybe that person wasn't running around in 1990. So it fell to other people to explain his work. And if you look at Bruce Hendrickson's webpage, he will point you to papers that he and others wrote explaining what Vaidya did. But let me give you the upshot. From Vaidya's work to now, we can now solve systems in Laplacian to accuracy epsilon in time number of non-zeros, order m, times log n. Okay, there's an extra log here we'd like to get rid of, times log 1 over your epsilon procedure. This is about as fast as you could ever hope to get. If you ignored the log n here, this would just be the amount of time it takes to read the system. So this is just a little bit slower than sorting. So this is really fast. I want to tell you now how this came about. By the way, this is the most recent result of Kudis, Miller, and Pang from this year. Okay, so I played a role in this. Sean Hortang and I wrote a paper which was theoretically sort of close to this. It was what we called a nearly linear time algorithm. The time in this algorithm was number of non-zeros times some power of log n here. I wrote 10 question marks. That should be interpreted as the last digit. The exponent was probably 100. This is, to us, a great theoretical success. It told us a lot about the asymptotic complexity of the algorithm. It was at least lower, for really, really large numbers, this is lower than m to any power greater than 1. But in reality, the 100th power of log n is really huge. So this is what I describe it as an algorithm only a theorist could love. But it wasn't practically fast. We think of this as evidence that there should be a fast algorithm. Once you know that your order of complexity is not some polynomial in m, but m times some logs, you can think about how do you get those logs down and make them lower. And the interesting thing in our work is there were many, many components that were improvable. And actually, each of them turned out, many of them are very interesting in their own right. So a lot of people wrote papers improving all of the components, and every year when I would give a talk about this, the constant kept getting lower and lower and lower and lower until, you know, now we finally just got a 1 up here, thanks to Kudis, Miller, and okay, so let me tell you quickly some of the ideas that went into this. Oh, yes, the question back there. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the preconditioned conjugate gradient. Yeah, so, there's going to be a recursive algorithm in the structure. So some of you will be familiar with multigrid, which is an algorithm developed in the scientific computing community, which is a great example of an algorithm that, okay, there are a few cases where you can prove that it works quickly. This is related structure. You can think of this as a provably correct multigrid, if you like. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So. Let me show you the beginning of the algorithm. It will look nothing like multigrid to you. You should see the algorithm. In the end, though, there is some very close relations. But in the beginning, it looks nothing like it. I'll show you what Vaiju did. So to begin, let me tell you what it means to approximate one graph by another Laplacian paper. So before I define approximation, I should give you inequalities. So I will say one Laplacian matrix, LH, is less than or equal to another. Okay, I need a notion of less than or equal to on matrices. The standard one is if the value of the quadratic form is always less than the value of the quadratic form in the other. So I need that for all x, the quadratic form in the Laplacian of H is less than or equal to the value of the quadratic form in the Laplacian of G. So here's one example of an inequality you get like this. If H is a subgraph of G, so recall this Laplacian quadratic form is a sum over edges of squares. So if I throw away some of the edges, I throw away some of the squares. Those are all positive. So I can only make it lower. So if I take subgraphs, the Laplacian of a subgraph is less than or equal to the Laplacian of the original. I will say that one graph is a T approximation of another. Oops, I shouldn't have put up this kappa. Sorry. If the Laplacian of H is less than or equal to the Laplacian of G, and that's less than or equal to T times the Laplacian of H, that will give me a T approximation. What does T times the Laplacian mean? Well, you can talk about T times a matrix. It's the same thing as multiplying all the weights in the graph G by T. So it's everything you want it to be, it could. It's also the same thing as multiplying this quadratic form by T. Okay, so now I've got a notion of approximation that we've rigorously defined. When you have an approximation like this, the preconditioned conjugate gradient will require the square root of T times log 1 over epsilon iterations. The main thing to know is that the better the approximation, the fewer iterations you need. Of course, the better the approximation, usually the longer it takes to solve equations in the approximate system. So there's a trade-off there. Okay. Well, Vaiju's first idea was to approximate a graph using a spanning tree. So let me tell you what trees are, in case you're not familiar with them. A tree is a connected graph with no loops, like this one here. The great thing about a tree is there's a unique path between any two vertices in a tree. Makes them very easy to analyze. That's another definition of a tree. Okay, so Vijay's first idea was to precondition using a tree. Oh, I should say the other great thing is trees are sorts of matrices where if you get linear equations in the Laplacian of a tree, you can solve it in linear time. Amazingly fast. So when you have linear equations in trees, you can solve them essentially in the same amount of time it takes to read them. Okay, so Vijay's first idea was precondition with a tree. The advantage of this, we said at every iteration we need to solve linear equations in this precondition or approximation. In the tree, that's fast. That's linear time. And then we can measure how good an approximation we get. So since H is a subgraph, the tree is a subgraph, I know the Laplacian of H is less than or equal to the Laplacian of G. So already one of my inequalities to measure quality of approximation is easy. We just need the other one. How do we go the other way? So Vijay first looked at this by thinking about these sort of networks and measuring how well does your original graph embed as a network into this subgraph, which is a tree. So two of the measures people traditionally looked at, like I learned about in graduate school in a parallel computing class, was dilation and congestion. So dilation is I take a look at any edge in my graph that I'm eliminating, that I'm trying to sort of simulate in my subgraph, and I look at how long the path is between its endpoints. In this case, this one is length 6, and that's the longest. You measure the longest of those, it's dilation. Congestion says if I want to simulate my original graph in this one, how many times does any edge get used? So like this edge here, you can see getting used twice to support this one and this one. Also, this was an original edge in my graph, so I'll also count 1 for that. So congestion was 3. And Vijay said, okay, we get an inequality here. The Laplacian of G is at most the congestion times the dilation times the Laplacian of H. So the way he took this sort of network theory to get an upper bound on how good a preconditioner you could get. And using that, he got some improvements in time that I know you can't see at the bottom of the board, but it's a little bit faster than, say, using conjugate gradients. The first real improvement in this was by Bowman and Hendrickson in 01, who observed that there's a better measure you can use, which is rather than multiplying congestion by dilation, they said sum up the length of the paths that are used. So sum up the length of all these paths. That's called the stretch of a graph with respect to a tree. They sum those, and they prove that actually you get an inequality here using that. The Laplacian of the graph is at most this stretch times the Laplacian of H. But of course, then there's a question of can I always find a tree in which this is small? So I need a better approximation. You know, the smaller this number is, the faster our algorithm will be. Well, it turns out in completely unrelated work, Alon Karp, Peleg, and West proved to us that for every graph there is a tree for which this stretch term is really small. I'll say m to the 1 plus little of 1. This was work done on competitive analysis of algorithms, completely unrelated area. But they proved that there is always a graph for which this is small. Since we cared a lot about this now, I and others have worked on improving this, so we can now get the stretch down to order m log m, and then there's a log squared of log log m. That will probably go away in the next few years, I hope. This is something, by the way, where we have algorithms, we can prove things about them, but there's room to make them faster. I believe we can get fewer edges, and I really want faster algorithms for doing this because a lot of people have been bugging me for code for this. Because it seems there are a lot of people who have graphs and they don't understand them well, and they figure, well, if I can at least approximate it by a tree of low average stretch, then that's a pretty good approximation, and maybe it will help them understand the graph. So there's definitely more to be done here. Okay, so I told you one ingredient. Now I got to quickly skip to another ingredient called sparsification. This is our notion of what it means to approximate one graph by a sparse graph, but not as sparse as a tree. So think having a constant number of edges per vertex. So what Tang and I asked is if for every graph, we could get actually a 1 plus epsilon approximation, meaning a graph that is less than or equal to G and then 1 plus epsilon times it is at least G. A very, very tight approximation for every graph. Here's an example. Here I drew the complete graph, and here I drew an approximation of it. Some of you will recognize the Peterson graph. You have to increase the weights on the edges. So you get rid of some edges, and you increase weights on others. You might ask, why did we ever think we could build things like this? Well, the reason was a few years before, Banks and Carter had done something sort of similar. They showed that for every graph, there's a sparse graph in which for every single set of nodes, the size of the boundaries is approximately the same. So that means the cluster qualities in the sparse graph are the same as in your original graph, almost exactly, within a 1 plus or minus epsilon fraction. So that means you drop some edges and you increase weights on the remaining ones. So that was sort of our inspiration. It's a special case of ours. What Shonghua Tang and I first proved is, again, a result I'll call only a theorist could love. For every graph, gee, we got a 1 plus epsilon approximation with the number of edges was like n to the 7th power of log n squared over epsilon squared. And that was just the existence result. The actual algorithm had a very high exponent there in the 30s. But the existence proof is sort of cool. It used some random matrix theory, spectral graph theory. The algorithms behind it were interesting. They introduced something called local graph clustering, I'll tell you about in a moment, that we used for graph decomposition. And people have done a lot to improve those things. But we eventually came up with better algorithms. Oh, let me skip that. So Srivastava and I came up with a very simple algorithm. It's a random sampling algorithm. It gets us down to order n log n over epsilon squared edges, which is about as good as you could hope for, almost. The idea is we're just going to sample every edge with some probability. And what is that probability? It's proportional to the effective resistance between its endpoints. So meaning you take a look at an edge in the graph, you attach one node to 0 volts, the other node to 1 volt, and you see how much current flows. The ones that flow less current are somehow more important. The ones that flow more current, there are more ways to get around them. You don't need them. So we just sample each edge at random with that probability. And this turned out remarkably to fit exactly into a theorem in random matrix theory of Mark Rudolphin. And this is exactly the term that sort of optimally allows you to apply his theory to get a very sparse approximation. The only drawback here was to compute these effective resistances we needed to solve systems of linear equations. So this didn't necessarily help us design a faster algorithm yet. I want to mention one other thing. We know that amazing sparsifiers now exist. So Batson, Srivastava, and I came up with algorithms that are deterministic. They're polynomial time, but not fast at all yet, where the number of edges is actually order n. There are no more logs in there, divided by your epsilon squared. And we know the constant is right and can only be improved perhaps by a factor of 2. So we know about amazingly good sparsifiers. And yet, again, this is an active area of work. A lot of people are asking me for these things, and I don't have anything good to offer them. I've had a stream of undergrads do projects with me testing out this heuristic and that heuristic for sparsification. The answer is we do not yet have a truly fast heuristic that gets you really good sparsifiers. But we will. I don't know about me. Sorry, someone will get that. But at least we've got a good enough theory here that it helps us solve systems of equations. Okay, so I can tell you briefly the end of the story of ultra-sparsifiers. What Tang and I realized was we combined low-stretch trees with sparsifiers to get something that's really sparse. We described it as a tree plus a few edges. So in black, I drew you a tree. In green, I throw the edges you put back in. And this enabled us to solve systems of linear equations. So let me not tell you about the algorithms. I don't have much time, but let me tell you briefly about what Kudis, Miller, and Tang do, which is much better and very simple. The way they built ultra-sparsifiers, they cut out a lot of our techniques. They took a low-stretch spanning tree, and then they throw edges from the original graph back in. And they throw them back in with probability proportional to their path stretch, that is, the length of the path between their endpoints in the tree. The longer the edges, the more you want to throw them back in. And this amazingly simple algorithm they proved gave us very good sparsifiers and ultra-sparsifiers. The amazing thing is the analysis of it goes through Srivastava's and my analysis based on effective resistances and sampling based on that. But they proved that what we were doing was just way too fine and detailed. Or, you know, we did something that was sort of optimized, but you could get really great results with something much cruder, and this worked. And now there's code by Yannis Kudis. So we now have fast algorithms and fast code for these things. If I can take 2 minutes, I will mention one last problem that I offered to briefly, which is local graph clustering. This is something, a problem that came out of this work that we don't need anymore, but for this, so it still gets used in a lot of places. The question was, imagine you have a massive graph, like the graph of everyone who's called everyone, or the Facebook graph, and you have a node of interest, some node here, and you want to find a cluster near that node. But you don't want to look at the whole graph. So you want to do this in time proportional to the size of the cluster. So you just want to grab a node and grab some of its neighbors and grab some of its neighbors and do this in an intelligent way so that you eventually output something that's a good cluster and you haven't read too many more nodes. So Xianghua and I intended to use this for graph decomposition. It turns out that people have used it much more in social network analysis and analysis of biological networks. It seems to be a useful way of finding clusters near a vertex, even if they have large computational resources. So I won't tell you how we did it. Let me just tell you briefly some of the techniques that went into it. So, well, Xianghua Tang and I did something based on diffusion. Anderson, Chang, and Lang did something based on personal page rank. This was the first really good algorithm for this. It improved on work of Jay and Wiedem and Birkin. This is the one people often use. There is one better algorithm by Anderson and Perez, which uses something called the volume-biased evolving set Markov chain. Because this is something done by Diaconis and Phil. It's the notion of a dual to a random walk on a graph. Again, something mathematicians were playing with, but seems to be exactly the right way to solve this problem, which is sort of amazing. And that is our best algorithm for this so far. There's more to come. Okay, so let me just give you some conclusions. One, there's a lot left to do. There are a lot of other families of linear equations that occur in a lot of applications, and we still want to solve them. And most of the components I've described to you here, we need to improve, and people want to improve, and people are trying to improve. I want to point out this work would not have been possible, one, without very powerful tools developed in a lot of mathematical and algorithmic fields that were developed for entirely different reasons. And, you know, we were fortunate to read a lot and know about them. But it would never have happened otherwise. I also want to point out that this would have never happened without the framework of asymptotic complexity of algorithms. So theorists like to study how will algorithms behave when their inputs are really, really huge, impossibly large. Google isn't that big a number when we think about it. But because we are thinking that way, it sometimes leads us to design faster algorithms. So when I designed something with an exponent of 100 and a log n, that was a completely useless algorithm, but at least led to a new way of thinking about the problem. And once you've got a new way of thinking about the problem, people can improve and refine that and get something that's actually useful. Well, like I said, if you want to learn more, all these papers and more, I have a web page on all of this that links to all of them. So if you actually want to see stuff with a little bit of an overview, if you want to see details, a lot of them are in my lecture notes. Thank you.
Time for one or two quick questions.
Yes, from the expert in the back.
Well, they have a result.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So there are no assumptions whatsoever about weights or graph structure. No, graph structure, no assumptions about weights either, except that you certainly do need enough precision to keep them around. But and when you get very large weights, your problem can become ill-conditioned. Right. You do need them to be positive. Right. You need a positive semidefinite, but no, there are no assumptions about weights or graph structure. No, we don't. Yes. Yeah. Oh, the condition number. But the convergence of these algorithms does not.
Right, right.
So the convergence of these algorithms, just to be clear, does not depend at all on the numbers you have in this matrix. Yes. So, okay, so the question is actually, for that question, how you measure what it means to be an epsilon approximate solution. And if you measure it in the matrix norm, then, which is actually the norm you usually care about for most applications, then it does not become an issue. So if you try to measure your error in the 2 norm, then you have to worry about the condition number. But in the matrix norm, you do not, I would assert. Though you do have to keep enough precision. But, yeah. So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wait, I should just warn you. This Laplacian equations had nothing to do with that airfoil. I just put it up because it was a pretty picture. And I'm not actually a computational scientist, so I don't think about airflow. That is, the physics of that are well beyond me. That gets to more complicated sorts of systems. So I just put that up as a pretty picture of a graph.
Well, thank you again, then.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.